Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is one of those classic behind closed door kinds of things. About all we know is that they're talking, the White House and Congress, that is, over what to do about Detroit. We can tell you where they don't agree. What we don't know is where they do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at splendidtable.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 9th of December today. And what seemed so certain yesterday about this time doesn't really look like such a slam dunk anymore. The haggling over a government rescue of the American automobile industry continues in Washington. Congress and the White House are still at odds over what conditions to impose on the companies, that in return for $15 billion worth of taxpayer loans. That should be enough to keep the big three in business until springtime. Longer restructuring plans would have to be in place by the end of March. What we know about negotiations goes something like this. There's talk of a car czar, strict consequences for any of the three that can't demonstrate their going concerns. And what kinds of fuel efficiency standards Detroit ought to be held to? Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more on that from Washington.
Environmentalists say for many years, U.S. auto companies ignored market warnings about the declining popularity of big cars.
That has to do with a huge management failure on the part of all three of these companies.
Daniel Weiss worked for 16 years at the Sierra Club, and now he's with the Center for American Progress.
The big three business model was based on cheap oil and gasoline, and being able to block stricter fuel economy standards. There's more profit to be made from making a big gas-guzzling car than there is from a smaller fuel-sipping car.
Many in Congress are asking for greener cars in return for a taxpayer bailout. Some think the 35-mile-per-gallon average by 2020 should be moved up by 5 years. Others are pushing for a faster switch to electric-powered vehicles. But David Cole at Detroit's Center for Automotive Research says Congress is pushing technologies that few car buyers can afford.
But ultimately, the market is going to determine what sells. Congress can't force people to buy. Auto industry can't force people to buy. And if you're in the business of making cars and trucks, you have to be in sync with the market or you'll go out of business.
Cole says more affordable batteries and alternative fuel engines will be available soon without government mandates. Congressional members from California and 15 other states are backing a bailout condition that car companies drop their suits to block tougher emission standards in those states. So far, the White House is resisting that provision. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The guy who was in charge of the last American car maker to get government money, that would be Lee Iacocca of Chrysler, weighed in today. He said he doesn't see any reason CEOs ought to be forced out in return for a bailout. Detroit aside, barely, this has been the year of the corporate bankruptcy. From Linen and Things to Tribune Company yesterday, the Chapter 11 filings are coming fast and furious. For consumers, though, life seems to be chugging along, even though every day brings news of more layoffs. That got us asking, when are personal bankruptcies going to start catching up with the commercial ones? We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out.
This fall, the number of people filing for personal bankruptcy has gone up dramatically. In October, for example, there were more than 30% more filings than a year ago. Jay Westbrook is a law professor at the University of Texas, and he says it's a pretty safe bet those numbers will keep going up.
There's a lag between 6 months and a year from the time that people get laid off or get divorced and the time when they actually file for bankruptcy. They're struggling, they're trying to get by, and then they realize they can't make it.
That's what happened to Mike McWhorter. He's a banker in Tennessee. He was laid off from his job and he couldn't sell his house. And meanwhile, his wife got seriously sick. And even with insurance, the bills really added up.
This whole process has been one of trying to rebuild my career, rebuild our financial situation. And now we've gotten smacked down again.
Major illness and losing a job have both traditionally been big causes of bankruptcy. What's different now is that consumers can't get loans to tide them over. Deborah Thorne is a sociology professor at Ohio University. She guesses we'll see wealthier people being forced to declare bankruptcy.
What I think we're experiencing now is our economic situation is affecting people who are more upper middle class, and those are the types of jobs that we're seeing lost.
She says richer people typically start out with more of a cushion than poorer ones, but many can't access their money because it's tied up in assets like houses and retirement plans. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Credit unions have joined the long line of bailout recipients. The Wall Street Journal reports today federal regulators will make billions in loans available to what are called corporate credit unions. Those are big financial institutions that pool money from retail credit outfits where regular people do their banking and then invest it for the long haul. But Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports those investments aren't looking so good right now.
The amount that's needed, $41 billion, is chump change compared to the hundreds of billions flowing to banks and brokerages. And the money would be lent to credit unions to temporarily balance the books. The books are unbalanced because corporate credit unions invested in securities that have plummeted in value, says Bill Hample, chief economist with the Credit Union National Association.
There are some asset-backed securities, you know, as in credit card loans and auto loans and student loans and those sorts of things. And some of them are also mortgage-backed securities.
Hample's quick to point out that corporate credit unions were more cautious than a Citibank or Lehman Brothers. The securities they hold are higher up the food chain and started out with stellar credit ratings.
They're still paying on schedule and they're behaving just fine, except if the corporate credit union had to sell them today, they would have to sell them for a lot less than they paid for them.
Which would hurt the retail credit unions because it's their deposits that the corporate credit unions invest. The fact that credit unions are suffering doesn't surprise Steve Kenny, a sales manager I met outside the Portland Credit Union where he banks.
This thing is so deep, it's beyond, I think, what anybody really expected.
Jessica Marino is a credit union customer who just lost her job at a Harley-Davidson dealership.
I try to stay out of the whole economy. It's kind of depressing, but my money's going to be okay.
Economist Bill Hample answers emphatically, yes, retail credit unions are still extremely sound. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Not so sound on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The shocker story of the day comes to us from the great state of Illinois, where Governor Rod Blagojevich has become the latest in a long line of chief executives in the land of Lincoln to have problems with the law. He was arrested this morning on charges of fraud and bribery. That includes, prosecutors say, conspiring to sell President-elect Barack Obama's recently vacated U.S. Senate seat to the highest bidder. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports that political power might be the one market that's recession-proof.
There are only 100 Senate seats, and anything there are only 100 of is bound to draw a hefty price on the open market.
I've got this thing, and it's bleeping golden. I'm just not giving it up for bleeping nothing.
Those are allegedly the words of Governor Rod Blagojevich, recited today by federal prosecutor Peter Fitzgerald.
And Governor Blagojevich talked about selling this like a sports agent.
The price for that safe Senate seat? A job on a corporate board for his wife that would bring home about $150,000 a year, and a substantial salary of his own for a do-nothing job at a foundation. Seems like a steal, so to speak.
If you are the governor of Illinois, you're in a position to make a lot of money, not just a little money.
That's Melanie Sloan of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington.
And yet repeatedly we see politicians take, you know, not in the millions of dollars, which we might expect, and which, by the way, we do see in foreign countries all the time. We see them in the United States selling themselves for a few thousand dollars at a shot.
Sloan says, amazingly, the price for access to power hasn't risen with inflation over the years. A former Rhode Island governor went to jail for taking about $300,000 in bribes for state contracts almost 20 years ago. Indicted Congressman William Jefferson was busted last year after $90,000 of alleged bribe money was found in his freezer. And Ted Stevens, the recently convicted senator from Alaska?
He sold himself for a $2,300 massage chair.
Talk about a deflationary spiral. But Governor Rod Blagojevich hedged his bets by allegedly practicing corruption on a number of fronts, including going after favors related to the sale of Wrigley Field and seeking campaign contributions in return for funding a children's hospital. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Almost everybody's been affected by the financial crisis. In particular, though, those hit hard by the housing bubble. In Pacoima, here in Southern California, the Mary Immaculate Parish is one such group. Parishioners are mostly low-income, mostly Spanish-speaking, and dozens of them are at risk of losing their homes. Father John Lesang's been trying to help them by organizing them to negotiate with their banks. I asked him when he first became aware of what was happening.
I was alerted to the problem shortly after I arrived in the parish, about maybe 5 months ago. A family approached me asking for prayer at the end of a Mass, and I said, "About prayer about what?" And they said, "Well, we're about to lose our house."
Well, Father, what's the parish doing to deal with this problem?
We began actually announcing at the end of each Mass, if you're faced with a mortgage problem, please approach a table that can be found outside the church after Mass and sign up. And, of course, those list of names grew quickly, and we had meetings where 80 to 100 people would show up at a time.
And so what you're doing is you're trying to have some sort of collective bargaining with the banks that hold the mortgages on these families' homes. Do I have that right?
That is one of a two-part strategy. What we're doing is we've grouped mortgagers according to their lending institutions, and then we are inviting the banks to send their representatives to meet with these cohorts, we're calling them, and to discover what kind of modifications they're willing to make.
What kind of response are you getting from the banks?
To date, we've had one such meeting between a group of about 30 homeowners and one bank, and it was Chase Bank. And we discovered that, as a rule, the banks are, at least Chase Bank and its affiliates, they're more willing to work individually with homeowners. And we're concerned that if you take each case only separately, we're never going to resolve this crisis soon enough.
I guess the other thing the banks are saying, Father, is that these people knowingly signed these mortgages, and there's only so much we can do to help them out.
Well, it's true that people need to take responsibility for the documents they sign, but I think it's also true that the lending institutions need to understand that not everyone is of the same ability, of course, to understand rather sophisticated tools. Even bankers can't understand all the ins and outs of this crisis. How can they expect a borrower to understand a contract that's many pages long unless they take the time to explain them?
How long are you going to keep going with these announcements after Mass, Father?
We're now forming those groups to meet with the banks. That's the phase we're in right now. Come January 25th, we've scheduled a meeting with various elected officials, and we're going to be basically showing them how the bank's willingness either does or does not match up to the kinds of legislative remedies that have been proposed to date. We feel that the proposals coming from Washington have served more the interests of the banks than they have served the interests of the homeowners and the community at large. And we think that all three interests have to be taken into account when a remedy is structured.
Father John Lesane at Mary Immaculate Parish in Pacoima, California. Father, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, finding new ways to keep charitable donations flowing.
So, you know, it takes a lot of little gifts to make a big impact, but everything we're seeing this year are ways to make those little gifts a lot easier.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial sank 242 points today, 2.7% to end at 86.91. The Nasdaq swooned 24 points, 1.5% to finish at 1547. The S&P 500, well, it sliced off 21 points, 2.3% to close at 888. FedEx decelerated nearly 15% today. The company says annual profit could come in as much as a third lower than analysts expected. Lower fuel prices didn't seem to be helping the company. UPS lost 7%. Investors pushed 3M stock down more than 2% today. General Electric dimmed nearly 6%. Procter & Gamble washed off 4.33% after UBS cut its price target for that company. The 10-year T-note gained. The yield slipped to 2.64%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for November. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee holds a hearing on investing in programs that would create green jobs and stimulate the economy. And the United Nations marks the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Seems like it's been all cars all the time in the news lately, and the same has been true in our inbox. 2 weeks ago, commentator David Frum said it's time to stop micromanaging the auto industry and just let things work themselves out. A lot of you agreed with David and told us you were surprised you did. Joe Lewis from Las Vegas, Nevada was one of them.
The best two-step plan for Detroit? One, help the big three retool to build greener cars, and two, use a gas tax to ensure those smaller cars are marketable. A gas tax is also the right thing to do for our kids and grandkids and their planet.
Kim Bruno from Washington, D.C. said amen to that, with a caveat.
Without a directive to spend the money on transportation, it will be wasted.
Turning from autos now to another heated topic, healthcare. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with healthcare economist Victor Fuchs as part of our series Taking Stock. Professor Fuchs said that for him, a good society would encourage individual as well as societal responsibility. Eric Saldinger is a radiologist from Walnut Creek, California, and he felt Fuchs didn't go far enough.
I listened to your interview with Victor Fuchs and had high expectations when he mentioned individual responsibility. Unfortunately, my hopes were dashed when he failed to use the term in its most significant context, the responsibility of individuals to maintain their own health. One of the main factors driving healthcare costs is the failure of individuals to maintain a healthy lifestyle.
Economic historian Neil Ferguson's out with a new book, this one about money. We talked a bit about how competition between banks helped lead to this little financial crisis we're having. And he said at one point in the interview that in some ways we're all responsible for the crisis. That didn't go over too well with Steve Presteman of Venice, California, and he made this comparison.
If I bring my child to a doctor who then kills my child out of negligence, am I equally responsible for the death because I believe the doctor would do his or her job?
Finally, an apology of sorts and a warning. This next letter is not really suitable for kids. A report on retail sales a couple of weeks ago made parents of young children cringe. Here's the relevant part.
And the NRF predicts a modest gain of about 2% in holiday sales this year. But for most retail analysts, that forecast is about as realistic as...
Yeah, she said it, the guy with the presents. Leslie Beck from Salt Lake City, Utah, and apparently a whole lot of others listen to this program in their cars with kids in the back seat.
Maybe next time we could be warned with a spoiler alert. That would be nice.
If you have spoiler alert suggestions or any other comments about our coverage, let us know. Go to our website, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There's a twist to the season of giving this year. A lot of us are cutting back, buying fewer gifts, going out a little less as we try to balance our personal budgets. But there are still people finding ways to squeeze in some philanthropy, because as good as it feels to get, it can feel even better to give.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
Today we're going to start our series on philanthropy with this question. Given the way the economy has been, are we giving more or less this year? Historically, Americans are a generous bunch, but with so many families struggling to get by, it's easy to see why groups that depend on charity are bracing for the worst. Jamie Bedrin reports.
Like many New Yorkers, Deirdre McArdle Manning is passionate about the arts. She always gives money to Carnegie Hall and the New York Philharmonic. But not this year.
Anybody who asked me, basically, I would give them a little bit of money, even if I couldn't afford to give them a lot. And I can't spend the money on the charities when I can't pay my own bills. So I have to kind of prioritize in a way that I've never had to before.
Manning's married to a doctor and says a doctor's salary doesn't go as far as it used to. Utilities and food are more expensive now, so she's adopting a wait-and-see attitude toward giving.
I want to see how things are generally to see if, you know, the 401ks come up, the savings accounts come up, all of these things that, you know, I'm in my late 50s. I'm not in my 30s and have 20 years to, you know, let everything recover.
Schools, universities, and shelters are seeing their donors take the same approach. Tom Hall raises money for the New York City Rescue Mission. He says a few foundations have temporarily called a moratorium on gifts. He's concerned, but is optimistic donors will continue funding organizations serving those in dire need.
A lot of people think this, what we do, is of a high priority. So in terms of the pecking order in giving, we may move up in times like this.
Patrick Rooney is with Indiana University's Center on Philanthropy. He says some foundations will likely prioritize their giving.
Some of them are saying that there's going to be greater giving to basic human services and trying to feed people and shelter them and train them for jobs and so on, as opposed to giving that might have traditionally gone to things like education and the arts.
Ultimately, Rooney says foundations plan over several years. Individuals give what they can when they can. Tom Namick is headmaster of the New Jersey private school Montclair-Kimberly Academy. Wall Street's collapse has meant a change in circumstance for some of the students' parents. Namick says giving has slowed, but he'll still be asking for money.
So if we backed away from that, I think that would be a huge mistake. It's not the asking that is the problem. People, I think, expect it. And it's almost a measure of respect that you go back to them with the hope and the expectation that they can do the same thing they've done for you in the past.
Back in New York City, Bobby Mark with Barnard College's development office says her school is feeling the pinch, too. She says calls from families asking for more aid have doubled since the school recently sent out spring tuition bills.
You can't say to the entire sophomore class, it's a bad time, we don't have enough financial aid, why don't you all take a year off? You can actually say, we're not going to repaint this building for another year or two.
At a time when people are giving less, donors are making more targeted choices. And when it comes to spending what's donated, recipients like Barnard College are too. In New York, I'm Jamie Bedrin for Marketplace.
While universities and other nonprofits are trying to make smart choices about their spending, there are other trends afoot designed to keep those donations flowing. We're going to talk about some of them with philanthropy consultant Lucy Bernholtz. She is here with the top charity-related buzzwords of 2008. Lucy, good to talk to you.
Hello, Kai.
All right, so first things first, I guess small is really big this year, right?
That's right. If you want to take an idea global, the thing to do is chop it up into little bits. Micro is our first philanthropy buzzword of the year.
What does it mean, though?
Well, it means take something small. Take a big idea and make it small. So we've got micro-consignment, micro-franchising, micro-endowment, micro-giving, micro-philanthropy. Big ideas made small.
Use it in a practical application. How might it work?
So a micro-consignment program, such as that which is run by Living Goods in Uganda, helps individual women become entrepreneurs, self-sustaining entrepreneurs, by selling single light bulbs or cook stoves or Band-Aids or other health products door-to-door. The women provide a much-needed service to their community in Uganda, which can only afford to eat, individual members of which can only afford to buy things in very, very small amounts. And the individual entrepreneurs get a sustainable income.
All right, let's keep with the M words here. Mobile giving is next.
Well, that's going to take the small and make it even easier to use. So now, since everybody seems to have a cell phone, why not let them give from their cell phone? You no longer even have to find your spare change to give to the Salvation Army, nor do you need to find a credit card. Just text the keyword to the right SMS number, and your $5 donation goes right to your cell phone bill, and Salvation Army or whoever it is that you want to support gets the gift.
How well does that work, though, in terms of people actually following through on that, actually doing the mobile giving?
Well, you know, it's a brand new thing. It's just taken off this year. It was launched at the 2008 Super Bowl with a campaign from United Way, and they're raising some money. So, you know, it takes a lot of little gifts to make a big impact, but everything we're seeing this year are ways to make those little gifts a lot easier.
All right, buzzword number three, please.
Buzzword number three, good gifting. So I'm sure you're familiar with the re-gifting concept,
yes,
right?
Not that I've ever done it, but yeah, sure.
No, no, I wouldn't think so. But good gifting is the feel-good equivalent of re-gifting. So especially in these tough economic times, people are looking for a way to act on their charitable impulses, but also, you know, pay attention to Aunt Martha or whoever it is that they want to recognize at the holidays. So they're either making a gift to their favorite charity in her name, or even more 2008, they're using a charitable gift card, giving it to Aunt Martha, and she makes the gift to the charity of her choice.
I don't want to get all cynical on you here, Lucy, but it seems to me that a lot of these mechanisms that you've described to us are in and of themselves business opportunities. Some smart entrepreneur can come up with some new way to do this, some new technology or some new methodology, and actually make a little money at it.
I just found out that you can now put your favorite charities on your Amazon wish list, so that when I share my wish list with you, you don't have to just give me a book. You could actually give to my charity, and I can assure you that there's a transaction fee behind that that's paying for the costs of Amazon managing that. So, yeah, there's lots of opportunities to make a penny here and there, and those pennies add up both for the charities and for the entrepreneurial folks with the technology backgrounds.
See, I knew it. Lucy Bernholtz is the president of Blueprint Research and Design. That's a consulting firm for philanthropic institutions, individuals too. Lucy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. Happy holidays.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about changes affecting religious charities in the new year. And if you want to know more about any of those buzzwords that Lucy was talking about, you know where to go, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which we take a brief foray into the world of bonds, and we are going to keep it simple. If you've got spare cash or thinking about investing in one-month treasury notes, save yourself some trouble. Just stick it right under your mattress instead. You'll get the same return, 0% interest. That was the yield on four-week notes at a Treasury Department auction today. Investors trading profit for knowing their money's going to be there when they need it. Three-month bills, even worse. The yield on them went negative briefly today, paying the government to hold your money. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow fell 242 points, 2%. The Nasdaq lost 24 points, 1%. The S&P 500 down 21 points, 2% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, a new set of rules for faith-based charities.
We do what we do out of our faith. That is what drives us. And we would expect those who serve alongside us to share that faith. And so we would not pursue any kind of funding that would limit our ability to do that.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.